Hi, and welcome to A Time to Thrill. It's me, your host, Amy Austin. It is August. First, I want to apologize for the unintended soundscape. I'm recording this while I'm in Budapest. They are a year into the exterior renovation of my building, also adding an elevator to a 140-year-old building. I have some feelings about that, but we will skip my thoughts on that. Additionally, my apartment faces the street, and there's a lot of traffic. I should probably record this at another time, but I've been out during the other parts of the day when it's quiet. Who knows why? So, welcome to August. It's been a hot one this summer. I have unapologetically turned on air conditioning. Such a non-European thing to do, or rather a very American thing to do, but here we are in a hot world. This month, I have the pleasure of interviewing author Kelly Garrett. So Kelly writes crime fiction. She used to be in LA, and her first couple of books are about Los Angeles. And her most recent book, Missing White Woman, actually takes place in Jersey City, New Jersey. She's from Jersey, so I assume that that's the reason why I think I didn't ask that during the interview. So here you go. It is an interesting talk, and I hope you enjoy it. In the meantime, So His Lost Mistress is done. It comes out in January. But right now I'm having it read by some early readers. If you're on the newsletter list, I'm sure you saw about that, because I've taken a little departure into the psychological thriller territory, and I wanted some feedback to see if I hit the mark in the way I wanted to. I actually haven't looked at the feedback. I've been traveling, so I haven't had a chance to do that. Actually, I was in Paris. So can I tell you this? So the Olympics were in Paris. I was in Paris, and I was trying to take a train, and they had all these people standing on the platform with blue welcome bienvenue vests and what looked like lightsabers, but I just like fluorescent light wands. I'm not sure what that was for. Maybe to get your attention. So I'm thinking, why are all these people standing on the platform? Getting into Paris hadn't been so bad. It was actually a little bit easy, which freaked me out, getting around Paris. So they're standing on the platforms. I swear to God, it was like a flashback to being in Tokyo. So they're getting on the platforms, and the train arrives, and the train is literally full. And I'm thinking, so I skipped that train, because they have a little sign up there that indicates how full the trains are. And I was like, the next one's in 5 minutes. I do not need to be on this train. It's 90 billion degrees in Paris. There's no air conditioning to be found. I'm sweating already on the platform underground. And the train is literally packed with people like a cattle car. Okay, I know I want to know why we pack cattle in a car like that. It seems inhumane. Okay, side note. Anyway, so I'm standing on the platform. So the next train, I'm like, you know, I have to get somewhere. Like, I can't stand around. I've already walked like a couple miles outside to avoid the train, but I'm tired of being hot and walking, and I'm not interested in walking like 5 or 6 more miles. And the buses in Paris are, you know, I've lived other places that have had more direct bus systems to get you from point A to point B. The metro is where it's at. So the next train arrives, and it is full like the last one. I thought, well, what's going to happen? So it's in a major train station, I assume. So people get out. Not enough people. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to try to get on. The people on the platform in their lovely bienvenue welcome vest proceed to Tokyo fashion push people onto the train until the doors can close. I have never been so close to humans. We're all going to die of a disease. I'm not even germaphobe, and I was just like, okay, no. Fortunately, like one of the Olympic venues was 2 stops later, and enough people got out that I could actually take a breath and move my arms. So that's going on. It's interesting. I didn't realize the like Olympic colors are going to be so pastel. So Paris is full of pastels. I guess if you check my Instagram feed, no, I haven't posted them yet, but maybe I'll post a couple of those pastel photos, the pastel banners, the pastel like street decals. the Olympics in a major city is interesting. The alternative, so the two cities that bid on it were Paris and Budapest. Budapest lost and Paris won. And it's actually quite fascinating because the mayor of Budapest is in Paris, like, seeing whether or not, like, they should make another bid. I'm going to tell you, I could live without it. The next one is in Los Angeles. I hope that I'm not there then. My goal is to fly here to avoid the Olympics there. As a kid, actually, I watched the Olympics and I really enjoyed it. As an adult, I stopped watching it because it became, at least in the U.S., I haven't watched it here that much. It's just, it was so many like packages of like storytelling about athletes and very little athleticism shown. It was like, here's a swim match and it's 4 seconds. I know swim matches aren't that long, or swim meets or whatever, but then it was like 40 minutes of commercials and talking about the athletes and their story and all that. While I think that's interesting, I want to see the feats of prowess from people who spend all their time training. And the Olympics stopped being that. I think it's different here. I saw it like on, they have public monitors, both in Paris and in Budapest, outside, like huge public screens where you can watch matches. And I don't know, when it's below 90 degrees, maybe I'll consider it. So, okay, that was a complete digression. Nobody needs to know anything more about that. I am on the fence about what is going to come next for Casey Kaur and Nicole Long. If you have any suggestions, feel free to email me. I think I want to write a standalone thriller, just a little palate cleanser. I haven't decided. Or maybe, who knows, maybe I'll dip my toe back into romance. Who is to say? But right now I'm taking a break, thinking about it, running around doing photography, going to museums, most fascinating exhibits, and living life a little bit. So that's a lot that you didn't ask for. So without further ado, here is my lovely conversation with Kelly Garrett. Hi, and welcome to Time to Thrill. This is me, your host, Amy Austin. This month, I am delighted to speak with author Kelly Garrett. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for the invite.
How are you today?
I am good. I know we just said it. I'm just waking up, so I'm great. I know you're a little bit ahead of me time-wise. I had a full day. I'm bushy-tailed and bright-eyed.
Okay. I can't say the same. My son and I decided to walk all the way to this art exhibit. It was a 40-minute walk and probably should not have done it
before doing this. You're like 20 minutes into something and you're like, this was a mistake. And you're like, kind of.
That's exactly what happened, but I couldn't back out because when the child is like willing to do stuff, you're like, let me double down. Okay, so I have about 1,000 questions. I will keep it to less than 1,000. But how long were you in L.A.?
People still think I'm in L.A. I've been out of L.A. for – I left L.A. in 2011, so I've been out of L.A. for like 14 years. But I was in L.A. for about 8 years, yeah.
Oh, that's a short tenure. So I've been in L.A. for 23 years, and in my head, it's 5 minutes, but yeah. So how did you come to LA? Because it's,
well. Oh my God, how far back do we want to go? Do you want to the short, you want to, was it the TLDR? What do you want?
Did you come to LA to write for TV or did you just gallivant to LA? Like, so I came to LA
no,
for the weather.
I'm a planner. I cannot like gallivant anywhere. And so I got my undergrad degree from Florida A&M, and I graduated 2000, magazine journalism. I was working at a magazine. I was working at Vibe magazine in like the early aughts, which is like when it was, I'm not saying it's not cool to work for Vibe now, but it was like really, really, really,
really cool.
Magazine in like 2000, like 2011, like 2001. And so I was there 2001, right after Leah passed away. And like literally my second day of work was September 11th. And so I was in LA, I was in New York and I was working there for 2 years and I didn't do music at Vibe. I did a lot of more, the other stuff, like the other entertainment elements for the front of the book section called Start. And like, I would just see a lot of people and I'm like, oh, look at all these people doing all this great stuff in film. And I, like, oh, I kind of, I'm like, journalism is great, but you're really writing about other people doing amazing things. And I kind of wanted to do something amazing myself. And so that was my thought process. But again, I couldn't just gallivant to LA. And so I applied to film school, and I was really blessed in that I got into USC, which I still think is the top film school in the whole entire country of the United States. And so I was at Vi for 2 years. And so in 2003, I came to LA for film school, was getting my degree in writing for screen and television. And so I spent 2 years there, got my master's, my MFA, and then I started working in TV. And I, you know, was an assistant, writer's assistant. And then I got into a program on NBC. And then I was on a show called Cold Case. And I got let go from a show called Cold Case. And I was just trying to find my way. And I think I have not been involved in Hollywood for a really long time. But like, it's not a stable income. Not that writing, not that books are, but it wasn't a stable income. And so I was just trying to figure out, I had just turned 30 and I was like trying to figure things out. And so I ended up coming back home. So
I have to ask you, okay. So I know a lot of people who, well, let me say this. I feel like you were writing for TV in the last throes of sort of the traditional, everything changes, but in the last throes of the traditional models.
Yeah. So basically, when once I left television, I did not pay much attention to what was going on. So when the last writer's strike happened, I was so confused that people were like, oh, I had a TV job and I still needed another job. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, in my day, when you got a TV job, you were set, like you made money. Even like as a staff writer, you're making six figures. And so, and my one season on Cold Case was the last writer's strike.
The one before. Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yes.
And a lot of the issues that they were talking about, they were still talking about in this last strike. Like, yeah. We'd gotten screwed over with DVDs, and we know that streaming thing is happening, and we don't want to get screwed over with streaming. And so that's what our fight was about back in like 2008 or whatever year it was, right? Mm-hmm, and so I was surprised, like, we're still fighting over that. Like, they were mad about that like over 10 plus years ago. And so I still get what if you've written for TV or no, but when you get a residual check from the WGA, you get it in a green envelope. Mm-hmm. And one episode of Cold Case came out in like 2008, and I still get green envelopes, right? And it's not like a lot of money. It might be like $100, but like I'm still making money off of a TV show. And I had a writing partner, so I got half of it. So I'm still getting money off of a TV show I wrote in 2008. Half a TV show, right? I wrote in 2008. Right. So I'm like, streaming, I don't think it's like that. I don't think it's as lucrative.
No. So it's changed a lot. I could go on for probably a half an hour about this. So I know a number of people who write for TV, but they're all my age. So I'm 52 and they're all about my age. So they did come of age during the traditional time when like there were programs and all of that. And I think there's maybe one left at Universal? No, Paramount? I don't even know if it's still around. So, okay, there's two things I'm thinking about. A, it's because when people talk about there being a showrunner shortage, they're like, there's not a deep bench, and we're looking, especially for like women of color, for showrunners. And I'm like, well, without traditional programs, it's hard for people to break into. That's one thing. But the other sort of thing is that the second job, I didn't know that either. And when the strike came, so I know some people who do very well on TV. Right. And I know people, I guess, who do less well. So when the strike happened, I was talking to somebody and they were like, why do you think I opened this like restaurant or something? And I was like, I thought it was a thing. Like, I want to open a restaurant. I don't, but I assume they did. And they were like, no, I needed a second income to supplement TV. And I had not. Okay, A, that's not the conversation we would always have. Like, you know, it's not like I'm opening a restaurant because I really need the money. But I was surprised that it had gotten, for some people I know, it had gone off the rails in terms of making an income. Other people I know have like overall deals and other things. And those people are doing fine.
Like, you could, like, if you got in, like, when Shonda Rhimes did Grey's Anatomy, started Grey's Anatomy 20 years ago, let's say you happen to get a staff writer, you could, if you stayed on that show right now, you'd be rich, because the show's been on for 20 years, and you usually rise within the ranks of the TV show, right?
Right,
but at the same time, I might have been put on a show that was against Grey's Anatomy that got canceled after one episode, and then after that, I didn't get I'm a staff writer and I might not get staffed again for 2 years. Like, there's just no consistency. And I can remember, Amy, I went to a meeting and it was a WGA meeting for women. And they were talking about how, like, if you get pregnant and your showrunner just doesn't want you to work, you can just get fired. Like, so all the like labor laws that we fought for in every other field, basically back then, and I don't know how it is now in TV, which is like, it's whatever your showrunner wants to do. And I mean, you could sue him, but you'll never got to work again. And it's like, that was like, where I was like, this is not the industry for me.
Okay. That's, and I could see that. So I guess. Okay. So since I've been in LA like 23 years, there's two sets of people, the people who are obviously never leaving and the people who come and go. Cause it's, I mean, I'm from New York City. So both have like that transient nature. People are like, I'm going to come here and make it. And then they decide to leave. So some people I know stay, but I know people who, so I had my child at like 38, which is, I guess, considered old, and for my own reasons, not for career reasons, but a lot of the people I knew were having, either they were actors or writers on TV and they wanted to have a child. This was the last, you know, we're at the end of the maternity window, but they knew that they were going to be unable to work.
Right.
So that hasn't, well, my son's 14. Have to think about it. It hasn't changed substantially. I'll just leave that there.
That makes me so sad.
Yes. And some of the issues are the same. And I have thoughts about reality TV and some of the issues about non-unionizing and other realms. But okay. In streaming, a lot of that, those issues are still, they're still problematic. But moving on. Did you like writing for TV?
No.
Oh, really?
There was so I guess I can be honest, like I said, I'm never going back. There is, so I was on a show called Cold Case and it was a great show and we had a really great showrunner, Venus. And like she, like some shows will like have you there like all night because they don't want to, the showrunner hates her family, doesn't want to go home, but she was very much work life balance. But you know, for those who don't know, for the, at least how in my day, it would just be people would come into a conference room, right? And they would, and we would just sit around the conference room and literally talk all day about the episodes. And I think if most people are honest about their actual day job, you might work 9 to 5, but you don't really work 9 to 5, right? Like there are times you're really busy and there are times when you are not busy. That's, you know, I think that's my job. I can admit that now, right? But TV, I had to be on and my brain had to be working 8 hours a day because they're in the room. You have to pay attention. You're like, you go to lunch when they say to go to lunch. And I would come home mentally exhausted. Right. And then the other thing was like, there was just so many other people who had to say, because if there was a studio spending like, you know, $1 million per episode for your show, they're not going to let you do whatever you want. They're going to want to have a say.
Notes.
So you would get really extensive notes from your showrunner, really extensive notes from the studio people, really extensive notes from the network. Network people are the people like our CBS and studio. I think Warner Brothers did Cold Case, right? And so it really wasn't your work, right? And so like, those are the two things. I mean, I enjoyed obviously having my name in TV, like the episode's still on Max, you know, and that. But in terms of me as a writer, like my books, every word in that book I wrote. Right. Like it's my baby. It's my creation. And so I didn't get that. The collaborative nature for TV just did not necessarily work for me when it came to writing. I mean, I loved brainstorming with people. I still like to brainstorm with people, but luckily I have friends and stuff who are also writers who we talk about each other's work and we can help each other brainstorm. So that element I still have, but the other elements of TV just did not work for me.
That's so interesting because I do. So I have not written for TV, but I do know a number of people who do it. So some people like the collaborative nature and other people are working with the hope that they can be the David Kelly or the Shonda Rhimes, where they are at the top of the pyramid. And therefore it's, I don't want to say it's less collaborative. They have more ability to direct the way things go story-wise. Yeah. I mean, so those are the two kinds of people I know. And some people I know but they have houses and children. They just can't quit. So it's like any job where they're in because that's the thing they know how to do. But I always have wondered about the collaborative nature of that because it feels like it's, in the end, it's not necessarily your vision, which is
no.
A, yeah.
But I don't want to knock on it because they're great. Like, I love it. I don't think I know everything, right? So the great thing about the room is that, like, I might have an idea and then you might have an idea based on my idea, which is going to make it better. And I'm not going to be like, well, I think that Amy thought I don't want to do it. Like, I'm like, oh, that's going to make it better. But I can get that through my editor. I can get that through my agent now. I can get that through friends who read my book and give me notes, right? But the great thing with that is that you might have a stupid idea, and if I was in TV, I'm like, oh, I have to take it because it's the showrunners. But like, if your idea is stupid, I'm going to be like, okay, well, thanks you, Amy, and I'm still going to do what I want. And I think that's more agency. I have more agency as a writer in books.
That's true. I will say this, that rooms are smaller now because I don't want to say budgets are not necessarily smaller, but there are less writers in the room. So that has created for some people I know a more intimate space where it's not 12 people. Let's say it's six.
Yeah. That's nice. You have an attention for 6 or 8 hours a day, even more now. So you can't be going down.
Free food. So, So do you think, and I'll ask you this, because I know people who have written for TV who have then switched to novel writing and they feel that it has made their novel writing, I don't want to say not tighter, better, but more compelling in terms of moving the story along. Do you think that it has had that influence on you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I just paid off my student loans and I graduated 19 years ago, right? So I had spent a lot of time when I decided to leave television. I was like, oh my God, I'm a loser. I spent all this money to go to film school and I'm not using it, but there are still elements that I use. Yes. Like there are certain people who read my books are like, oh, it should be a movie. It's very cinematic. And I think it's because I have that background where like in TV, you only get 42 minutes. I think you know, it's a little different now when you're on streaming, but if you're on network, you still get 42 minutes and because of commercials. And so you just can't have a character walking down the street smelling, like if they're smelling the roses, it's because it's a plot point, right? It's going to have to be very long. And so I think I try to do that with my books too, where every scene, either I'm introducing a character or I'm planting some kind of plot point, or I'm, you know, setting something up for later. I'm doing something. Right. That's going to move the plot and the story along. Good with dialogue. I think because you have to be really good with dialogue. Good dialogue. Mm-hmm. It sounds realistic and not really is because like it's all like, ooh, hi, how are you? You know, like you can't have that. If I'm doing that in your TV shows, because I'm avoiding something, I'm hiding something. Right. Again, it's a plot point. But there are bad things too. Like I really suck at description. I hate to read a lot of description in books. I have to go back second pass and like, oh, describe the room. Describe what her hair looks like. I won't describe characters, you know? So I think there's certain things I don't do well. And I think it's also because TV, you don't have to really describe what the character looks like in depth because they're going to cast who they want anyway, right?
Right. That's so interesting. I will say this. I don't like writing description either. I like dialogue. And after that, I care less. So my second pass is where were they? Where are they? What are they doing? I have to go find out where they are, where they're sitting, how close it is to the next location. Not my favorite, but I know people who love description. Actually, I was reading a book today. I started a book today and the description was excellent. And I was like, this is, it was describing, I'm not going to get this, a part of Texas that's really hot. And I was like, this is really descriptive and I can see this and I don't at all write like
it.
So I appreciate that people do it. It's never going to be my thing. I'm never going to hear from a reader. I stayed up all night and I felt like I was there.
smell what she was smelling, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't get that at all. So then how did you make the transition from TV writing to novel writing? Because some people, when they give up TV, they go do something else completely.
I still have a day job, right? So I had left. I decided to leave in 2011. My grandmother had passed away the year before. I was just like living. If your family's all in like New Jersey area and you're in California, like it's not like you can just get in the car and drive there, like you know, and be there in like 10 hours. It's a days long trip. It's not easy to get home. Time difference. Mm-hmm. I was missing too much stuff. So I came back. And I was like, I'm going to try to get a day job. So that was also a whole different thing of trying the transition of a day job. But I had the idea for what would become Hollywood Homicide. I was still in LA. And I took forever to work on it. So I had the idea. I had started it in NaNoWriMo in 2011, November. And I didn't finish it until 2014. And I got into a program called Pitch Wars, which no longer exists, but was amazing, which paired you up with a, if you had a finished manuscript and no agent, it paired you up with someone a little further along. So they might have an agent, might have a book deal, and they help you revise your book for what they had. It was an agent showcase. So I did Pitch Wars, did the agent showcase, got agents could like read the first 250 words and then request more. And I had only two requests, and one of them turned out to be from my agent, Michelle Richter. I can then go into the hell that was trying to get it published, but that's happened. So that was, I think, end of 2014-ish that Michelle and I got connected. So we're 10 years.
Did you enjoy, let me say this, because, okay, I can write a book now, which is, I know how to write a book now and it doesn't break my brain, but writing that first book took me years because I couldn't, even though I had read thousands of books over dozens of years, it still was a more difficult process than, it was just difficult. I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but sitting down and writing a story was way more difficult than I'd anticipated. Writing that first book.
Okay, I will say every book is hard for me. Like I've emailed with you. If you look down at my signature, because I hate writing, I love having written, which is a Dorothy Parker quote. And that has been my quote for over 20 years on my signature since I had my Gmail account. Right. And so I hate writing, period. So no book is going to be easy. However, I'm like, I know you're from a former lawyer. I came from television. I came from journalism. Every job I've ever had has been writing focused. It just might have been creative. And so I understand story. That's one good thing about my degree from, USC that took me forever to pay off, is that it taught me how to write a story. So I think, figuring out plots and stuff, it's stressful, but once I'm in the groove, I like it. So it wasn't hard in that sense of I don't know what I'm doing. It was just hard in the sense that I hate writing. I don't want to do
it. So what do you hate about writing? Because I don't, let me say this. Some days I like it. Some days I don't mind it. It's like dishes. Some days you're like, and some days you're like, I could not do
that. No, never dishes either. the blank page scares me. That idea that you can do whatever you want scares me. It doesn't get me excited. I'm like, ooh, I get to figure out the whole world today. Once I have the basics established, it's different. So I'm like a super plotter. I've gotten better, but my first book, 30 page to single space, three act structure outline. through the third act when I was writing, And so, that's the thing, is like that safety net. On the flip, I love to rewrite. I love to I call my first draft my vomit draft, and then I come and I clean it up. And so I love rewriting, but that first page, right now I'm supposed to be working on a story, in the next book. Everyone's my agent's waiting for it, my editor's waiting for it, and I'm chilling. And it's just because I haven't figured it out yet. And I know I'll get there, but it's not happened yet. So.
Oh, okay. So my brain, I have a completely different, I don't plot. I love to sit down. The first 20,000-30,000 words are the joy. That's the joy. You're like, look at this. You see this is coming together. Then you have to write the book. I think I might enjoy it more. So you were saying, I don't want to say how difficult, because I had a lot of difficulties with my first book, and I had a great agent and lots of things, and I could not sell it in 2001. It was a long time ago. Because at the time, I'll tell you, the agent I had, who now I'll not name, basically editors were like, we're not really that interested in with Black characters.
Hello. Welcome to our world. But no, I didn't tell it easy. That was what I was saying. So I've always loved crime. My mother is a huge crime fiction author, like an author, a huge crime fiction reader, and she gave me free rein of her bookshelves, and I will forever appreciate my mom for that. Also, obviously, for other reasons too, but just because my love of reading was from my mother, and she did not stop me. And I always joke, like, I was reading Jackie Collins at 11, but also I was reading cozies and crime fiction and Sue Grafton. And so my love of crime fiction comes from my mother being letting me read what I wanted to read. And so I was just super naive, where I was like, I also was lucky, Amy, in that I'm a little younger than you, but not much. And so I was a teenager in the 90s, and that's when like Walter Mosley had broken out, and Terry McMillan, and there was Barbara Neely, and there was, Valerie Wilson Muncy. That was like the first time that publishing was like, oh, black people, like people, if we have a black character, well, people, they might read it. And so then of course they made it a trend, and of course, like you said, by the time you came around in the early 2000s, except for like Walter and a couple other people, a lot of those black authors who I loved writing crime fiction as a teenager in the 90s weren't able to be published anymore because they treated it like a trend, right? And so I have this book. I thought it was a cozy. It's this like lightweight, really, in my opinion, super funny book, kind of like a Stephanie Plum. And it's about a black woman who is, like, called her a semi-famous mega broke black actress. She starts, the whole book is about her trying to solve a hit and run. She happened to drive by for the reward money from the police, and the shenanigans happen, right? And I had trouble getting an agent, and I think they would like the pitch, the query, and then they would say no. And I think because in my original query, I didn't put she was black. Okay. So I think they saw the book and they realized she was black, and all of a sudden the same thing, like, oh, it's not for me. Oh, I blah blah blah. And so I finally got my agent to Michelle Rick my Richter, who at that time was a baby agent at Fuse Literary. And it took us a year to sell it. Okay. And so every big publisher said no to it. And we did do a slight revision, but then we went back out and they still were saying no. And then finally, after a year, a mid-sized publisher, Midnight Ink, Terry Bischoff, this beautiful, lovely woman who gave so many of us who weren't fitting the stereotypical trends in crime fiction a chance to write with her, with Midnight Ink. Took a chance on it, So I got the deal in 2016. It came out August 8th, 2017, and it went ended up winning. It got starred, 2-starred reviews, Book of the Week, ended up winning all these awards, like the Anthony and the Agatha and the Lefty. It was like, when it came to critical, like whatever the big things in crime fiction were, it did all that. And it was again the same really funny, lightweight book. And Terry didn't do a lot of edits on it, and it's like, I say that just to say that I think sometimes with us, they go, oh, you're not, it's because you're not good enough. It's like, no, it's because we don't have the opportunities, right? And so, but again, when I did that in 2017, Alexia Gordon came out the year before with her book with a small press. And then my year, Valerie Burns and Patricia Sargent, who was writing as Olivia Matthews, they came out with their cozies. Right. But again, they are both with Kensington. So they were not with the big five publishers. Now, Rachel Housel Hall was publishing with a big five publisher. Her book was a police procedural, but it was the only person. So like, they were not publishing black people back then. And we were kind of like, we were start, I will give our, I'm going to give us credit. We started this new wave, and I think our success, I think, we again, we're showing people we're not at Walter Mosley levels, but we were showing people that we can, if you publish us, people will read it. That's the struggle. And I think now, once again, it's we're trendy, and I think we're all excited, but I think we're also afraid because I saw the 90s. I know that it lasted, forgot about us, but I don't want us to be trend. I want us to be a status quo. I don't want it to be a big deal that I don't want to be a big deal that a person of color gets a book deal in crime fiction. I got what? Oh, another one? No big deal. I don't want that. We're not there yet, but I'm hoping we're getting there.
Are you a creative looking for a new writing and reading podcast? Check out Dark Side of the Word, a weekly podcast for all the dark story lovers out there. Co-hosts Kate and CJ are two writers and bloggers who love to talk about their creative projects, their thoughts on that trending spooky story, how writing their latest novels is coming along, and much more. Each month's episodes are broken into four categories: writing updates from the trenches, content recaps, current events in the writing and publishing world, and a monthly book club that reads dark-themed books. All topics are dissected and discussed from a writer's perspective. Watch Dark Side of the Word on YouTube or listen to the audio-only version on iHeart, Apple, and Spotify.
So I guess then, but let me say this, despite those hurdles or moving in that lane, your novel did very well. So I have a friend, I forget who her first publisher was, but they did not submit her for best first book for awards, and she's still salty about it like 20 years later. Because you can't do it the second time unless you change your pen name or something. But with those struggles, were you, I don't want to say surprised, how did you feel about getting those best first book awards or best debut?
I mean, I was excited about it. I think also just because at that time I wrote like fun, very girly books, you know, and I think, you know, just like there's a racism problem in crime fiction, there's also a sexism problem in crime fiction, right, where people will say they don't, you can tell, even if those who, some people have outright said that, you know, the cozies aren't real books, you know, aren't real, yes, crime fiction, serious crime fiction.
Yes.
It, you know, and so I didn't expect to have that success that I had, you know, like, especially with the Anthony Award. Like, I was up against Jordan Harper, amazing guy, really nice guy, and had like this huge book, you know, I forgot the name of it, like my mother has on her bookshelf, and like, you know, won the Edgar for, you know, best first. And I was not expecting to beat that him, you know, with my cute little funny cozy. So it was a nice surprise, especially because it was such a hard struggle. I had wanted to write a novel since I was five. I was just too scared. And so like, I'm like, oh, I actually did it. And it's been, you know, it was accepted well. Was it a huge seller? No, but it was accepted well, right? So so that was great and nice. So
did you find it gratifying, I guess, then to, so, you know, this, how can I say this? Many of us toil away endlessly in obscurity. And so to do the toil and then have like the barriers, but then have like a really, I don't want to say a great ending. It would make a great TV show, a great movie. To then, you know, to get to the struggle and then get the recognition, was that gratifying?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It was definitely gratifying. But I do think also, I think sometimes people think, because, you know, I knew a lot of debuts my year. You know, right. One thing about me, I'm a started group, right? So I started a group of debut authors in 2017. And I think, you know, a lot of times, I think when you think you get the book deal, you think it's going to be happily ever after, right? Like,
yes, you're going to be,
you know, like, yes, Harley Tobin and Michael Connelly and Stephen King.
Yes.
And guess what? Most, for 99.9% of us, that's not going to happen. So I think,
I know,
because I was in Hollywood and I kind of knew that, again, that industry makes no sense. My expectations are a lot lower than other people's expectations. I mean, does that not mean I obviously still want to be a huge seller, but I wasn't assuming that was going to happen to me.
Yes.
So, you know, I think I came into it a little differently, you know, and just, again, even now, I think there are obviously still issues, you know, like once you get published, just other concerns happen. You know, it's not like, oh, well, once you get an agent, it's, oh, will I get a book deal? Once you get a book deal, it's like, oh, will I get success? Will I,
right,
get another book deal? Will I get good reviews? So the goalpost always moves.
That's true.
I try to tell people, just, that's why it's really important for you to enjoy when you hit that goalpost, because a lot of people don't get that. You know, as the farther along we go, the less people get it. You know, like, most people don't get agents. And then out of those people who have agents, I'm not going to say most, I don't know the numbers, but a lot of them don't get book deals. And then those who get that first book deal, a lot of them don't get a second book deal. Those who get a book deal, a lot of times, you know, so it's like, you have to, every time you hit a goalpost, enjoy it, because the odds get like harder and harder for you.
It's so true. So then I'll ask you this, because this has happened to, I'm going to say universally, probably 99% of the writers I know. But how did you feel when your imprint stopped? Well, let's say, I don't want to say closed, but stopped accepting new writers, excuse me.
You want the honest answer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't care. I was three books in. It was a three book deal, right? Mm-hmm. And the first book went good, right? And it was, I think they were also surprised at how acclaimed it was, right?
Right.
Second book, that's when the issues started happening. I think also the rose colored glasses were offered me, where I was like, a good example, because this is not Terry's fault. My mm-hmm. second book was supposed to come out a year after my first, and I had done everything right. I needed to do. I had got it in on time, and I had da-da-da-da. And I happened to email them a question. This is not Terry. This is someone else who worked there. And he's like, oh, by the way, your book's not going to be in stores tomorrow.
Oh,
by the way? That's not oh, by the freaking way. Like, you know, like if you know that there was some quote-unquote issue with the printer, and I've been busting my butt to promote this book, people are excited about it because of the first book did so well, you know? Mm-hmm. And you are just going to tell me the day before, by the way, it's not coming out. Like, it's not going to be in stores. Like, yeah. Stuff like that where I was just kind of like, this doesn't seem right. And, like, they would want me to go places but also pay out of pocket. And not saying that your publisher should have to pay for you to go everywhere, but if you want me to go to an event to help you promote stuff, at least, like, give me some gas money, right? So there were just certain things I was starting to feel very much like, this is not working for me. And so and I was at a point where I was like writing the third book and I was behind on the deadline. And I was just kind of like, what am I going to do with this contract? Because I still love this series. I still love these, like the people in the series, but like, am I going to, it was also really hard to write that the third book. Cause I was making the same jokes. It was hard to keep it fresh. And I was kind of like, okay, the intent was to become like a Jen Ivanovich and have like 20 books in this day series, but I'm mm-hmm. struggling with elements of writing the third book. My publisher, they're doing things that it's not making me feel appreciated. Like, what am I going to do when this contract is up, right? Am I going to try to renew it? Am I going to try to get a new contract or do a new series, write something different? And like, but again, like, I'm a Black woman. I know how long it took me to write that, to get that first contract. It would be dumb for me to walk away from more book contract with the publisher.
Yeah.
Like, I was having all these emotions. I think that's also why the book was late, because I was just like, what am I going to do? And then like 3 days before my birthday, we get an email from Terry saying, because she didn't even know, oh, they closed, Llewellyn closed Midnight Inc. You know? And it was like, part of me was sad about it, because I love working with Terry, and they got me my dream, and I will always appreciate Llewellyn for that. Otherwise, I was like, oh, I am, this decision has been made for me, right?
Yeah, so that's true. I guess that is true. That,
like,
is true.
I will not be writing any more Dana books because the publisher is closing. Like, you know, and so that was made for me. And I was like, okay, well, let me just, you know, realize that that's been taken out of my hands and I have this new opportunity. Mind you, it took me 4 years to publish another book, but it was bittersweet.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's happened. So, well, I know a lot of people in crime fiction it's happened to. Let me not say that, especially a lot of cozy imprints. And then crime, well, we could go into that. But it's happened with a ton of people I know in the romance community. And depending on where you are in your career is depending on how devastating it feels to you. So if it's like book one, and I've known people, you know, they sold a book and they closed to tomorrow. That's really devastating. If you're like a few books in, or this is your third publisher, you know what I mean? Then you're like, okay, let me put the shoes on and like keep walking to the next thing. But
it's always going to continue.
But it's still, it happened to me. I mean, it's still, it wasn't a shock so much because when it happened to me with one of the imprints, you remember Yahoo groups. And so other authors, you know, we were talking. So the writing was more or less on the wall. And then the question is, what do you do next? And that was, you know, that's about that publisher. But it still is disconcerting because the plans that you're making have to be. I remember sitting here, it was 2014, I think. I remember sitting here thinking, okay, so now what? Like, you know what I mean? You're like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
And that's, it's, hard. Looking back years now, it's easy. It's you can get through it, but it's still not world's best situation. Yeah. So,
I think the other thing is like, it's also, I feel like sometimes you have to think long term. And I think that mm-hmm. that a lot of times we will think short term, right? It's like long term, what's best for me in terms of like, okay, like this short term, it would be best for me to do like publish this book with this publisher that I know is not probably going to close, right?
Right.
It might be better for me to not to say no to that contract and, you know, maybe have to wait a little longer, like a year, but have a contract with a better publisher. So things like that, which is, again, it's really tricky because like you never know still because there's no right. reason to this industry at all. But I try to think not just short term, but long term, like what is best for me long term. Even like when I chose Mulholland for my sister, I was thinking long term, this is the best publisher for me.
That's so interesting. It took me years to have that ability to see that because I think it's hard because you're writing a book, at least for me, and I'm caught in the weeds. So I'm caught in the weeds of writing an actual book and then to back away and then also think about writing as a career. Those are two, that's to me, I found it difficult. Now
I saw some interview that some author did, and she's mentioned author hat and writer hat, and they're two different hats, right?
Yes.
Like a writer hat is that's the person who's at the computer writing the book, but sometimes you got to take that writer hat off and put the author hat on, and that's the business person, and that's a struggle too, trying to balance both.
It took me, but I feel like, to be honest, it took me maybe like 5-10 years to not feel attacked personally by every like wind that blew by. And now I care so much less, but I used to care so much more. And now I'm like, it comes and goes and tomorrow it'll be something different.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let me ask you this. I have two different things I want to ask you about. Let me ask you this. Okay. Let's go back. What made you, you're one of the founding members of Crime Writers of Color. Mm-hmm. And what possessed you to do that? Because I won't say this. I will never get up tomorrow morning and think I should start a group. What possessed you to do that? Because it's a very interesting group. I actually have no idea how I heard of it or became involved. That's one of those things that like I thought about it yesterday and I was like, I have no idea. Somebody must have told me. Obviously, I don't live in like, you know, things don't come down from the sky. But what possessed you to do that? Because it's a very interesting idea. There has not been one for romance that I know of. And now I think we should have one, but okay. But what made it come to pass?
I've always just been a doer when it comes to things like that. Not writing, but when it comes to things like that. But also I had, when I came out, so I kind of got into the industry around 2014. And as I mentioned, I was in this group called Pitch Wars. And the great thing about Pitch Wars was that someone started a group for all the mentees in our class. And it was great because we were all in the same place. And so we could collect, we could commiserate with each other.
Right.
Right. And we could also kind of ask each other questions and create a safe space. And then the other thing is I was a member of Sisters in Crime and I joined the Guppies chapter and those are how I made my first friends. And the Guppies chapter of Sisters in Crime is intended for, it's called The Great Unpublished. It's again intended for those of us, people who were not published yet. Mm-hmm. It's gotten way bigger than that, but that was the intent. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a place to, you know, commiserate, ask questions, get advice, help each other out. And so I was legit surprised, Amy, that there was not a Crime Writers of Color.
Okay.
Like 2016. I'm like, why isn't there one? And so I had started conversation with DG Pondian, who had been with Midnight Ink and who was just so nice to me. Like I had read, I'd been reading her for years. So met me at Malice, invited me to coffee, offered to blurb my book. Like she was just so nice to me. And I was like, we need is helping each other out, being able to talk to each other. And then someone else had told me, Naomi Hirahara had put in a comment that Walter Mosley wanted to start a group. And I was like, that's great. But like, how am I ever going to meet Walter Mosley? Like we don't hang out in the same circles. And then Amy, this is how I know it was fate. The week later I got invited to do an event with him. And I was I can meet Walter. I'm going to tell him. So when I met him, I said to him, I want to start a group. He said, he called me. We just were talking. And his thing is, I guess Eleanor Taylor Bland, who was, again, in that wave with him, when she was alive, she was the organizer. And so she was the one who kept Walter and Valerie and Gar Anthony Haywood like together and to do events and stuff. And then when she passed away, unfortunately, no one really took up the mantle.
So Walter,
he enjoyed that with what Eleanor did. He wanted to recreate that. And so the group started in summer of 2018. And I invited everyone I knew, and Gigi invited everyone she knew, and Walter invited everyone he knew. And so it started off with 30 people, you know, and like same thing where it's like, I was very actively recruiting. So I don't, depending on when you joined, I might've recruited you. But at this point, I don't recruit anymore. And so
I don't remember either. It's so weird.
Like someone will be like, Wanda Morris, like, oh, I was at an event. I met this Black woman or this Asian woman who is, you know, wants to write crime fiction. I told her about the group. You know, mm-hmm. And so now we have over 400 members, 450. And you know, and I think I don't know how active you are in it, but it's like, it's so great because it is such a safe space, you know, where mm-hmm. we're all equal, you know, like mm-hmm. Someone who's just starting out could ask a question and like literally Naomi Hirahara or Vaseem Khan will respond with advice. Or Dorothy Kumsa, will respond with advice. And it's like, mm-hmm. we're all equal. And it's truly an amazing safe space. You know, if anything, it's too active, but I'm happy because I'm glad people feel so comfortable that they can kind of come in and ask questions. Or my favorite thread is what we call the good news thread, where any good, mm-hmm. good news you have, you put it in there and we all cheer for you. Like that,
yes.
That to me is just, I'm so glad that's the space that we've created. I think it's exceeded Walter and Gigi and my expectations. And we're just so in awe, you know, and to kind of like, we're getting recognitions, like Mystery Writers of America gave us an award a year ago. Yeah. VoucherCon is giving us an award this year. Like it's exceeded all expectations. So it's amazing.
Okay. So this is going to take a turn. There's no good way to segue it. So I this whole working at home writing, I have no sense of date and time. I read Missing White Woman.
Okay.
And I have some questions. So let me ask you this. Let me say this. One of the things I've been thinking about over the last, let's say, 6 months, probably a year, is the idea of social thrillers, that thrillers that also, I don't want to say have a social message, I don't want to make it sound preachy or after school and specialist, but sort of take on a topic that people otherwise wouldn't talk about in the context of crime fiction. But I have no idea. What was the catalyst, or what was the thought behind the story?
I got the idea. I was at a friend's house. I was doing a writer's retreat at her house in Baltimore. It was like a 4-story row house. Mm-hmm. Working like a sister. And she was not there. And I have a very overactive imagination. And I literally was on the third floor bedroom. And I was like, I could go downstairs tomorrow and find a dead body and have no idea how it got there. And her neighbors would be like, who are you? Why did you kill someone? So that's the idea behind this woman. I'm a Black woman. I write Black women, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't necessarily like my job. I don't think we have to always write about racism. You know, I don't think mm-hmm. we always have to have a message behind our stories. However, as a Black woman writing a Black woman in America, it's going to have certain racial undertones just because it would be really unrealistic. Like me walking up to a cop is going to just be a different feeling than a white woman walking up to a cop. Or especially me as a Black woman walking up to a cop is going to have a different feeling than a Black man walking up to a cop, right? So I think to ignore that would not be a true book. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I've always been fascinated with missing white woman syndrome, which is the idea that when missing women, white women go missing or something happens to them, it gets a lot more media coverage than when Black and brown women go missing mm-hmm. or murdered or things like that. And like, I'm older, I'm 40, I keep saying I'm 46, I'll be 46 soon, but I'm not 46, I'm 45. Okay. So in the early aughts, like Lacey Peterson disappeared and Shonda Levy. Mm-hmm. And so I was so fascinated because I'm like, when people your age disappear, like, oh wait, like I could be in danger, you know? And it occurred to me right away that like all the news was always white women. And didn't mm-hmm. happen 2 years later, but someone pointed out it was usually just white women. And so, I just kind of thought it would be interesting to kind of take that trope in domestic suspense. Missing women is such a trope of domestic suspense, but
it really is. Yeah.
What is the Black perspective? Right. You know, and it's, if I wanted to do a missing Black woman book, you know, it would be a different book in terms of media coverage. Like there would be not as much, right? But right. I think it would be really interesting to take that missing beautiful blonde trope that you see in, like, you see it in Gone Girl, right? But what is the black perspective? Like, how do I put it a black woman in this situation? And that the thought was like, oh, she's the person who found her. She's the person that people are thinking that was involved. Her boyfriend, her and her boyfriend were involved in it. And how was that going to affect her when they were, and she's trying to figure out what happened. And so that's where the idea came from. And there's a huge, you know, we're saying social thrills. I thought you meant social media at first, because there is such a huge social media element.
Yes. Yes.
To,
and that part, I'm going to be honest, I don't partake of social media a lot. So for me, that was, I'd have to really think about it. Cause I was like, I know there's like TikTok and I know there's Twitter or X, and I know that it has an impact on people. It's just not my experience of life. So I was like, I was really, after reading, I was like, so can they bring more attention on something? Yes. Is the attention positive, good, or productive? And that was a different thing I'm actually going to think about, because I hadn't thought about it. Because I grew up in the, I was telling my son today, I grew up, you know, we had like, I lived in New York City. So we had like, you know, three networks and like, you know, three independents and like PBS. I mean, it wasn't that many channels. So, and TV went off at night. So, you know, the attention was very focused and very limited. But with social media, it can be diffuse, but people can bring a lot of attention to things that otherwise would not get it in mainstream media. And I hadn't considered that, especially with the whole amateur sleuths being so popular right now as well, with podcasts and that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, that seems like a lot. It felt like a lot. I was like, that's a lot that I haven't thought about. Why? And I was asking you this. I read a couple other books this summer with missing women, and I've noticed it's popular, and I'm trying to figure out, and maybe you haven't a thought about why it's so popular. Part of me wonders why it's so popular, and part of me wonders if we should do something about it. Like, something, just, you know, women just going with it. I think
it's your own personal fears, right? Like, I think as a woman, like, I walk, even the street I walk down, I'm like, oh, that street's a little too dark, or that street's a little too, you know, it's too empty, right? I always say that, like, if I'm walking down the street and I see one man behind me, I'm like, what is it? The whole comment, like, you go, there was, I don't know if that hit where you were, but it's been a whole discourse in the U.S. recently. If you're a woman and you're alone in the forest, would you rather encounter a bear or a man? Right. And most women are saying they'd rather encounter the bear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that's the thing, is like, for me as a woman, is the world is not a scary place. However, it's this place where I feel like I always have to be on guard to keep myself safe. And so I think when it comes to certain things, what are biggest fears when it comes to being a woman, I think are going to be a little different than biggest fears when it comes to being a man. Like, you know, I live in New Jersey. I work in New York City. So I'll go on the subway and I'll see a man sleeping on the subway. And I'm like, imagine feeling so safe in your world that you feel like you could go to sleep in a public place.
Okay.
My world is not that. Like, I'd be literally so afraid for my life to go to sleep in a public place. Like, I don't know if I'd get robbed, raped, kidnapped, killed. Like, those are my fears. Like, it could be 3 a.m. I could have been partying all night, and I'm going to be wide awake with on the subway, both hands touching, like, gripping my backpack in a hug so no one takes it and runs. You know? So I think that to me is like, what are the common fears you have? And let's put that in a book and a different story. So.
Okay, I'm going to have to think about that, because I'm going to be honest, it's not something I think about, but probably because I don't go out at night. I mean, I you know, I'm a morning person, and I don't...
If you don't go out at 5 in the morning and, like, by yourself, do you?
Yeah, I mean, I go biking in the morning, like, 6, 7 a.m., but I'm moving on a bicycle. But I'm a morning person. To me, the morning always feels safe, but that just may be my feeling. I'm really gonna think about it, because I'm gonna be honest, like, I read a book called Local Woman Missing, like a Mary Kubica book, a few weeks ago, and I thought to myself, they were talking about who's missing and whether her husband killed her and then somebody else went missing, and I thought, maybe you should look into the fact that women go missing and not be like nitpicking about who this person is and all of that. But I will think about it differently because it's not, that is not the, I have a lot of fears and that's not on my list. Mm-hmm. Okay. You answered that question. So let me say this, this is going to be my last question, but what do you anticipate for your future? Do you think, okay, I will say this. It feels like your first book and this book are, they're not diametrically opposed, but they're very different. They're still crime books, but they're very different.
That's the question I'm dealing with. And I think I'm having a crisis of conscience of what's right next. I feel bad. My poor editor, who's not even my editor technically anymore because I'm out of contract, was on maternity leave. And I was like still about to go on maternity leave. And I was like literally like bugging her with questions and thoughts and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think I want to try to do something and go kind of bridge the gap between the super light world of my first two books and the, I don't write dark. I'll never write dark. Even my second two standalones are not dark, right? Like they're about murder and investigating, but like, there's not like a torture or abuse or rape. No. Thing, right. Like, so they're books you can read at night or on the beach. I kind of want to bridge that gap and kind of do something that's a little bit lighter, you know, a bit more fun. I have an idea. I just have to, again, I hate this process. I have to figure out what I have the hook. I got to figure out what the story is. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say this. I'm actually at the same point. I was talking to a friend the other day and she's like, what are you going to write next? I'm like, I have a thought, but it's different. And I'm not sure. Yeah, I have a thought. A thought is not a book.
Exactly. People think it is.
I know, but I was like, all I have is a thought, and that's not going to be 60, 70, 80,000 words. It's really a thought, and maybe half a title. So yeah, how do you feel being at a crossroads? I will say that.
I hate it. I hate writing. I think I was really lucky, Amy, that I had the idea for Hollywood Homicide and it clicked. I knew what I wanted to do for Hollywood Ending. When I got the idea for like a sister, it clicked. When I got the idea from a young woman, it clicked, and I haven't clicked yet, and that's freaking me out.
Well, how can you say this? Because I have a friend who's very zen. Have you made peace with the uncertainty?
Oh, my God. I have not. Oh, yeah.
I'm still in LA. It is what it is. Well,
I'm like friends with Walter Mosley now, which blows my mind. Like, we're friends. Mm-hmm. Like, he'll call and check on me. And we were at breakfast recently, and I was literally complaining to him about this. And he was just like, why don't you just open up the document and write a sentence? And I was like, that works for you. Walter Mosley very, 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 very well. Does not work for me, but I like love that he was just like, open up the document and write a sentence. Like, God, I was like, I'll try. So.
See, he's making peace with the uncertainty.
He's the person, like, Walter loves writing, like, literally, like he gets up every day excited to write, like, and like he thinks I'm so weird because I hate it, and so obviously it works really well for him, but I'm just not that person.
Yeah, I don't know if I love to write. I'm gonna think about that. It's what I do, and if I don't do it, I feel crazy. But that's also true for exercise. I mean, there's a lot of other things that I feel the need, I feel a compulsion to sort of do to keep it sane in here. But I enjoyed Missing White Woman. I look forward to your next book. And I want to thank you so much for chatting with me today.
It was a fun convo. You had me very honest. So it's obviously you're a good interviewer. So thank you.
Honesty is it's what I traffic in. My readers have mixed feelings about that. So they really do. Because I get all the emails. But it was great talking to you. And I'm so glad that you spent the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been A Time to Thrill with me, your host, author Amy Austin. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you share, rate, and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It will help others find and enjoy my conversations with brilliant women creators. Also, please hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. In addition to hosting this podcast, I'm the author of the Nicole Long series of legal thrillers. The first 4 books in the Nicole Long series are now live. You can download Outcry Witness, Major Crimes,
without consent, and The Murders Began to your e-reader right now. I'm also the author of the Casey Court series of legal thrillers. These titles are available wherever books are sold, your local library, and also an audiobook. My next book, His Last Mistress, is available for pre-order wherever you get your books. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Legal Thriller Author. You can find me on TikTok at Social Thriller Author. You can also find this podcast on Facebook at A Time to Thrill. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you soon with more great conversations.